The Church of God, the Eternal, presents the 25th message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, April 18th, 2026.
So we do want to get right in now to the continuation of this series covering the life of David in 1 Samuel. If you will remember in the last installment, we saw that King Saul was strongly pursuing David here and there and wherever David fled. But with God's help, Saul was unable to trap him. David could easily at one point have killed Saul in the cave, and yet demonstrated one of the most significant thing about David's character compared to other human beings, as I pointed out to you. His respect for God and the will of God and the authority of God as it's manifested in the human kingdom, not to lay his hand upon God's anointed. That's what David called Saul, even though he was his mortal enemy, and he could have saved himself a whole lot of trouble if he'd just taken the opportunity to cut his throat, and instead David didn't do it because he had more respect for God. So David then afterward appeals to Saul, and it moves Saul so much that he in essence repents, quote unquote. He's sorry, he cries. He changes his mind and says he now realizes that David's never been a threat to him, and that he's not going to chase him anymore. Of course, David doesn't believe it because he doesn't go up and hug him, let alone return to the court of King Saul. He, with his men, continue to hide out in the wilderness. So we're going to continue on now in chapter 25 of 1 Samuel. We pick up the storyline. And the very first sentence here is, and Samuel died. So we could spend a lot on this, and we're not going to do it. It says, Samuel died, and all the Israelites were gathered together and lamented him and buried him in his house at Ramah. I don't know if that means they literally, you know, buried him in the floor of his house, or it just means in his home area. The Jews were taught by God to bury and bury immediately for cleanliness sake. So however that was handled, and yet what seemed to follow was a very major national memorial, if you will. The world would call it a wake. We would call it just a memorial after his death. And so it says, all the Israelites were gathered together. So they made a major demonstration out of celebrating, well, I don't want to say a celebration of life. I hate that term. That's what the world calls it, celebration of life. Sorry to mock anybody who is affected by that. But, I mean, it's not a bad term. It's fine. I just personally don't like it. We're not afraid to say somebody died. They didn't pass away, because that implies the false doctrine of immortality of the soul, passing from one state to another. There's no immortality of the soul. When you die, you die. That's what the Bible calls it, and returns to the dust from which you came. So it shouldn't be a problem for us to talk about dying. And that's what God did here when he said, and Samuel died. He didn't say Samuel passed away. He actually died, and they buried him. And then the nation celebrated, if you will, the memory of the history of this man in the service of God and all that he had done over his entire life. Think of a solemn and a unifying spectacle. Thousands gathering in and around Samuel's hometown of Ramah, all to honor the man who had guided Israel for virtually his entire life. And so it is a respectful reminder of the significance of certain key individuals in the plan of God and their impact, not only upon the nation in their day, but all of this has been recorded, which is why you and I have been covering it in this book. Samuel was likely either in his late 80s or up into his middle 90s. We've kind of covered that before. We don't know for certain, but he was very old. And so he had a lifetime of service to the people of God. Now, what about the fact that here we are, this is supposedly a book for Samuel, and we commented this on the very beginning of the series, kind of with the setup. But here we are in chapter 25 of the book called 1 Samuel, and this is Samuel died, and yet we ascribe the writing of this book to Samuel. So what gives? Just as a reminder, who are the potential authors of the books of Samuel? Traditional Jewish history views it that Samuel himself wrote all of the first portion that we've been reading up until his death. Whether that's true or not, it makes sense. So I go with that, meaning through what we call chapter 24. I don't think he wrote chapter 25, since this is where he died. So the question would be, who wrote the rest of the book of 1 Samuel and that which we call 2 Samuel? Because it wasn't Samuel. Well, turn with me to 1 Chronicles 29. 1 Chronicles 29, 29, and 30, because this tells us something that's not definitive, but gives us a clue. Very likely, it was two other prophets of God named Gad and Nathan, and we've already seen about Gad. Gad came on the surface as one that God sent out to give a message to David about coming back out of Moab and coming back into Judah. So you've already been introduced to Gad. But here, 1 Chronicles 29, 29 says, "Now the acts of David the king, first and last, behold, they are written in the book of Samuel the seer." Now, we don't have a book called Samuel the seer. Very likely, though, that's exactly what all of the portion that we have covered from chapter 1 through chapter 24 was likely an ancient book that was called the book of Samuel the seer. And what else? And, so we're talking about the whole life of David from beginning to end, and in the book of Nathan the prophet, and in the book of Gad the seer. Verse 30, "With all his reign and his might, and the times that went over him and over Israel and over all the kingdoms of the country." So the entire storyline that we're talking about here is found in three books: the books Samuel the seer, the book of Nathan the prophet, and the book of Gad the seer. We don't have the book of Nathan or the book of Gad. Well, I think we do. They've been incorporated in, saved by God, brought down, preserved, and are part in the organization of the books we call 1 and 2 Samuel. So I suspect that what follows here from chapter 25 on is likely, my guess is written by Gad. Nathan, at least we haven't been introduced to him yet on the scene. He's going to become very prominent in 2 Samuel, and especially because as a prophet, he's the one that God sends to King David to tell him that he's a sinner after the sin with Bathsheba and being responsible for killing her husband. So these are key figures. They are witnesses in the storyline, and God apparently used them to write down the chronicle of these events, which you and I are reading now. All right, back to 1 Samuel 25, the last part of verse 1 says, "And David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran." All right, a quick reminder. I've done this several times, but I want to keep doing it. It's valuable to me to think about the progression of David's age through this, even though God doesn't choose to give us those year markers. It is all presumption, it's assumption, but we have certain markers that things happen between one point and an ending point. Remember, ultimately, the first God did record that when he began to rule over the southern tribe of Judah, it will be at age 30. So everything in the run-up now to the death of Saul and Jonathan and David beginning to rule at least over a portion of the nation of Israel is in his 20s. So we're somewhere in the middle at this point. And again, as I mentioned to you in the last installment, how many years has elapsed even into the storyline we've had? I don't know. I'm presuming we're approximately 5, perhaps 6 years into his exile since he's been on the run, which means, and that's because I'm presuming a total of 10 years in exile, which may not be accurate at all. And again, there's other ones who think it was maybe as little as 7 years or maybe more than 10. I'm just picking 10, it's a round number, which presumes then that he would have gone on the run at age 20, and that we may be around age 25 to age 26 at this point, just for an assumption to kind of add something to kind of the flavor of the storyline. So if he was 20 years old when he fled, I'm going to assume he's 25 or 26 at this point, at the time that Samuel died. So let's say he's either 4 or 5 years out yet before the time that Saul's going to die. What about this wilderness of Paran? This can cause a problem because there is more than one. So the first one that a lot of people will think about is the wilderness of Paran, which is documented in the book of Exodus concerning the Israelites now roaming through that portion in Sinai. He is not all the way down, hundreds of miles away down in the Sinai Peninsula. There is another wilderness of Paran, which is literally within the confines of the territory of Judah. Okay, so he's basically staying in the same high desert area now in southern Judah as he's moving from place to place with his army and their families. So this wilderness of Paran is actually near, and we're going to see it in the storyline now, a city or a town called Maon and Carmel, which are going to be key now here, which are towns in the southern Judean hills. And this is the general region that David has been haunting, I'm going to say. All right. Verse 2, we get into the story of Nabal and Abigail. Very fascinating storyline. All right. 1 Samuel 25, verse 2, there was a man in Maon whose possessions were in Carmel. Now, wait a minute. If he's in Maon, why Carmel? So apparently, his residence was in Maon. Carmel was only 1 mile north. I looked all this up. Okay. So you're talking about his business being run out of all of his barns and all of his flocks and all of that, just a mile away from where he lives. But both places are named. All right. And the man was very great. So this was a wealthy man. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats, and he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. So we're talking about sheep shearing season, a big event. And if you understand some that goes into that, it will make some of the storyline actually come together a little bit more for you as you go along. I'll try to point that out. Verse 3. Now the name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife, Abigail. And she was a woman of good understanding and of beautiful countenance. So she had the full package. She was beautiful and brainy and wise. But the man, Nabal, was churlish and evil in his doings. He was of the house of Caleb. All right, so who's his ancestor? Caleb, who you know was the only one of that first generation of those who came out of Egypt in the Exodus, who was allowed to actually go into the promised land. Other than Joshua and Caleb, all of the other Israelites who came out, who were under the age or over the age of 20, died in the wilderness, and God made an example out of them because of their rebellion. Caleb was an exception to the rule. However, this descendant of Caleb does not have Caleb's character, as we are about to find out. So Caleb was actually of the tribe of Judah, which is why he was awarded land in southern Judah, likely in the very area that we're talking about now that his great descendant Nabal is still inhabiting. All right, verse 4. Oh, and by the way, this word churlish, it says the man was churlish and evil in his doings, and it's a Hebrew word that means harsh, rude, and surly. That's what churlish means. So this was his nature. This was his behavior. This is his general attitude that he brings to probably most of his interactions with people. Harsh, rude, and surly. Verse 4, and David heard in the wilderness that Nabal did shear his sheep. And again, I'm pointing out to you that sheep shearing season was a big deal. Because, number one, it would require a lot of shearers to come in. You would employ them special during this time in order to take care of the shearing of an entire flock. And you're talking with thousands of sheep. That's a big job. All right. So traditionally, they actually made a festival out of it. So this is not a holy day festival. You can call it a sheep shearing festival. It's a time of year. By practicality, you're going to bring all these extra people, these hired people together in order to shear the sheep, which means you're going to have to feed them. You're going to have to take care of them and provide for them. So in essence, it turned into a gathering that also included celebration. So one of those annual events besides the commanded holy days of God. So David heard that this great wealthy man of the region and where he's hiding out is shearing a sheep. And David, verse 5, sent out 10 young men. And David said unto the young man, get you up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name. And thus shall you say to him that liveth in prosperity, peace be both to thee. So David wanted to send his emissaries and make sure he showed respect and honor to this landowner, and to assure him that David's intentions were peaceful, because again, David's got 600 soldiers following him. And if you think Nabal didn't know about him, you got another guess coming. Although that's not what he says shortly. We'll find that out. But David sends his emissaries, 10 young men, with a special message to say, peace be both to thee, and peace be to thine house, and peace be unto all that thou hast. Which is an assertion that David is no threat. He's not sending his men with a threat to say, give me something of value or else my army and I are going to take it from you or somehow extract something else. He's saying, we are not coming with ill intent towards you, your family, your possessions, and your employees. We literally come in peace. Verse 7, and now, continuing the message to Nabal, I have heard that thou hast shearers. Meaning, you've got all these extra people in your employ right now for sheep shearing. Now thy shepherds which were with us, we hurt them not, neither was there aught missing unto them all the while they were in Carmel. I don't know what period of time this is. The normal shepherds that are a part of Nabal's entourage at all times to take care of this massive amount of livestock, plus now the addition of the shearers that come in. But in any way, what David is saying is, we know your men, we've been around them, and we've been helping take care of them. We've actually acted as defenders, which you're going to see here. Now thy shepherds, which were with us, we hurt them not, neither was there aught missing unto them, all the while they were in Carmel. Verse 8, ask thy young men, they will show you. Meaning, don't take my word for it, coming from David through his emissaries. Ask your own employees what their interaction with me and my men have been, and they will tell you it's been positive. Ask your young men, and they will show you. Wherefore, because of that fact, let the young men find favor in thine eyes, these 10 men, for we come in a good day. What does that mean? Seems obscure. This is a reference to the special feast at sheep shearing time. That's what a good day, meaning it's a special time when they actually have more food abundance, which is specifically prepared and brought out to take care of all of those that are shearing the sheep. It's a festival time because of all of those necessities. So David is saying, I know you've already got a lot of food and things prepared in order to take care. Can we have some too? That's in essence what he's saying or asking. Give, David says, I pray thee, whatsoever cometh to thine hand unto thy servants, and to thy son David. He's not even saying, we're demanding that you give us X amount of food and necessities for me, my 600 men and their families. He's saying, we're just appealing to you as a rich landholder who's been greatly blessed to share a small amount of your wealth with us. You choose how much. We're not making a demand. You choose how much to share. So the truth is, had David and his army acted differently, had they thrown their weight around, which they could have, Nabal could have been a victim. And that's not how David treated him. David is only asking for kindness. What's Nabal's reply? Verse 9. And when David's young men came, they spake to Nabal according to all those words in the name of David and ceased. So they said exactly what David sent them to say, and then they shut up and waited for Nabal's reply. Verse 10, and Nabal answered David's servants and said, cockily, dismissively, who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? Wait a minute. And hear him say, maybe his men introduced him as the son of Jesse. It doesn't say so. Perhaps he did. But Nabal is acting like he's totally ignorant. Like, David who? Who is this guy? I've never heard of him. He's a nobody. He's no concern of mine. Who is David and who is the son of Jesse? There be many servants nowadays that break away every man from his master, proving he knew exactly who David was. He's literally now mocking David for being on the run from King Saul, which he knows very well. And again, he's been on the run probably at least 5 years, maybe six at this point. I think the entire nation of Israel knew exactly who David was from the time he slew Goliath. So he was big news. Whether you liked David or whether you didn't like David, everybody knew who he was and probably were waiting for updated news on what David and his men were doing whenever it came out. So Nabal's playing dumb here. And all he's trying to do is mock and show disrespect to David. There be many servants nowadays that break away every man from his master, saying it's your own fault if Saul's trying to kill you. You brought it on yourself. Why should I help you? You're just a renegade. Verse 11, shall I then take my bread and my water and my flesh that I have killed for my shearers? See, an acknowledgement, there's an extra amount of food which has been prepared. Animals have been slaughtered to provide meat and food now for this festival at the shearing time. And Nabal's saying, really, you think I should take a portion of all of this which has been prepared for my employees that I've killed for my shearers and give it unto men whom I know not whence they be? I don't know David. I don't know their men. I have no obligation to them. And frankly, I don't care, is what he's saying. Verse 12. So David's young men turned their way and went again and came and told him, David, all those sayings. They reported exactly what Nabal said. How did David react? He did not say, oh, well, too bad. Let's move on somewhere else. And here's where you find out something else about the natural character of David. Verse 13, and David said unto his men, gird you on every man his sword. And they girded on every man their sword. And David also girded on his sword. David was going to war. Nabal showed disrespect to him. And David's reaction was, I'm going to show him. All I asked was for kindness, a mere opportunity to share a little bit in the great blessings that this man, this wealthy man, has. And not only did he say no, he replied with disdain and disrespect for me and my men. And David says, I'm not having it. Put on your swords. And there went up after David about 400 men, and 200 abode by the stuff. So he's still His army is still approximately 600, which is what it's been consistently now over this period of time. He leaves 200 literally to take care of probably their families and all of their possessions, and he takes 400 of his men with them to go basically exact his revenge on Nabal. Nabal was about to find out who David was. He claimed not to know who he was or care. David's about to introduce himself to Nabal. So in the meantime, one of the shearers, or the shepherds of Nabal, who was there as a witness to this interaction between Nabal and the 10 young men of David, and he knew trouble was coming. And so what did he do? He ran to Abigail. Verse 14, one of the young men told Abigail, meaning one of Nabal's servants, went to Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, he basically laid out exactly what happened. Behold, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to salute our master, to show respect and honor to our master. And he, Nabal, railed on them. This is how the shepherd reports it. Nabal railed on them. Verse 15, but the men were very good unto us. He's confirming now exactly what David's men said. We've showed you respect, and all these, I don't know, weeks, months that they've been living in the wilderness nearby, and they've been actually acting as a security force for Nabal and his enterprise. When shearing time comes and they have this big feast, was it really out of the question to ask for a little bit of kindness to receive some food? And here this man is confirming exactly what David said. The men were very good unto us, and we were not hurt. Neither missed we anything. They didn't steal from us. As long as we were conversant with them when we were in the fields, meaning during the entire time that they were in the company or presence, and they apparently were around each other. Verse 16, he says, they were a wall unto us both by night and day, like a security force. David and his men actually provided comfort to these shepherds, made them feel safe from other interlopers, let alone wild animals or whatever it may be. They had the special benefit all this time by David and his men being in the area. All the while we were with them keeping the sheep. Verse 17, and don't forget the fact, David's history from a boy being a shepherd himself. So do you think there's an element, having been the defender by himself out with his father's flocks, learning to use that sling in order to protect those flocks from the wild animals? He killed a lion, he killed a bear himself. So he had probably an affinity for these shepherds and literally showed his benevolence toward them. Now therefore know, the servant tells Abigail, now therefore know and consider what thou wilt do. He's appealing to her to do something. For evil is determined against our master. Now, how did this shepherd know it? It doesn't say he had any intelligence. And the 10 young men who took Nabal's railing back to David, they didn't know, but they could tell what was going to happen. They probably actually had interacted with David, let alone his soldiers, and knew about him and his character. And like, if you show David respect, he shows you respect. But if you disrespect him like this, all hell's going to break loose. That's in essence what this shepherd is implying. For evil is determined against our master and against all his household. And that was exactly true. For he is such a son of Belial, that a man cannot speak to him. This word, Belial, literally means in the Hebrew, without worth. That's what it means. And here's a shepherd literally making this statement about his boss to his wife. Now, I mean, that's pretty significant right there. How many people would do that? To literally call out your boss to his wife and call him a worthless, wicked, evil person, which is what it implies. Why would he do it? Was he really taking his life in his hand? Or was it common knowledge, including to Abigail? Exactly. The shepherd felt safe in saying what was true to Abigail. In essence, everybody knew it. This is the character of this guy you're married to. And he just literally told the truth. It was apparently Nabal's typical nature and the way he dealt with everyone, not just David and his men. So it wasn't necessarily that he had an axe to grind with David. But this churlish orientation was exactly the way his interactions with people went. That's what everybody expected. It was his habit to behave this way. Verse 18, here's Abigail's reply. The shepherd came to her and told her the whole story and said, in essence, please do something because something bad is about to happen. Verse 18, and Abigail made haste. She didn't dawdle. She didn't say, I'll think about it. I'll sleep on it. She saw the immediate urgency of the situation and the danger that she and her whole family and their entire family enterprise was facing because of what had happened. Abigail made haste and did what? Took 200 loaves of bread. 200 loaves and 2 bottles of wine, 5 sheep ready dressed. They'd already been slaughtered and dressed. 5 sheep ready dressed and 5 measures of parched corn and 100 clusters of raisins and 200 cakes of figs and laid them on asses. They used these donkeys and now loaded all of this food on these donkeys for transport. Verse 19, and she said unto her servants, go on before me. Behold, I come after you. So she sent these donkeys laden with all of this food ahead, and then she's going to catch up. But she told not her husband Nabal. So technically you can say she's not being a faithful wife because she's doing this behind her husband's back. Okay, that's accurate. But your husband is such an idiot, he's about to get you all killed. I don't know, where's the line? Where does the wife have a right to say, this is for self-preservation. My idiot husband, and you're going to find out that's his name. He's a fool. And he probably did it. He didn't do it with the idea that he was confronting David and putting him and his whole family and his whole enterprise, his business in jeopardy. This is just the way he acts to everyone. And he has an opportunity to show disrespect for David. I don't owe you anything. I don't know who you are. Get away from me. He has no clue what he's doing, but his wife does. Was she wrong, in essence, by going behind her husband's back and now loading up all this food? Because Nabal said, no, I'm not giving you anything. And now his wife is literally going to give all the food that David was hoping for behind her husband's back. You judge. She told not her husband Nabal. Verse 20, and it was so, as she rode on the ass, that she came down by the covert of the hill, and I don't know how far away David and his men were camped, away from. Now, apparently all of this food and all this was literally in Carmel, which is where the business was, not where her house was. It doesn't give us that detail. How far away was David's camp? How far are she and these men with all these donkeys laden with food traveling? We don't know. Some distance, probably not a great distance. She came down by the covert of the hill, and behold, David and his men came down against her. They were on their way. So they met somewhere in the middle. Because David, with his 400 soldiers and their swords, are on their way to Nabal. They literally come across Abigail and her men laden with food, and they crossed paths. David and his men came down against her, and she met them. Now, verse 21, this is a reconfirmation of David's intent. David is not coming in peace. He has not been mollified by thinking it through, by sleeping on it. His wrath is just as strong. His determination is just as severe to take his revenge on Nabal. David had said, verse 21, "Surely in vain have I kept all that this fellow hath in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that pertained unto him." He says, "I have wasted my time voluntarily taking care of this man and all of his wealth for whatever period of time it was." He says, "I went out of my way." We sacrificed literally to take care of all of these shepherds and their sheep and their other livestock. And this is how we are repaid. "And he hath requited me evil for good." He's repaid me evil for good, meaning Nabal. Verse 22, "So and more also do God unto the enemies of David, if I leave of all that pertaineth to him by the morning light any that pisseth against the wall." How determined do you think David is to take his revenge? I think very. He's so determined, he's saying, "I'm going to show you what happens to somebody that shows me such disrespect." It's one thing to have to put up with it from Saul. And you can imagine this whole thing literally boiling over in the mind of David. He has showed incredible restraint in dealing with Saul because he's God's anointed. He doesn't have to do that with Nabal. And it appears that David's saying, I'm up to here with this idea of showing respect to people who are disrespecting me and making themselves my enemies. So and more also do God unto the enemies of David, if I leave anything that pertains to him, Nabal, by the morning light, any that pisseth against the wall," which just means all the males. Well, that's a rude term. Yeah, but it's in the Bible, isn't it? Yeah, it is. There's quite a number of them like that. The New Living Translation actually phrases it this way: "May God strike me and kill me if even one man of his household is still alive tomorrow morning." So that's how David is taking it. What's he planning to do? He's taking his 400 men, and he's going in there and killing Nabal and all of the men, his family, the males of his family, and all his servants. Makes me think about all this nonsense going on today with the wokesters, all this trans nonsense, these people who don't know the difference between a male and a female. That's one of the key requirements, the ability to piss against a wall. Which identifies a male. Just saying. So in case you were thinking that David was just a peacenik, good old David, because after all, he's a man after God's own heart. That's the way God viewed him. As if he was some monk, you know, or some one like Samuel, which he was not. We also, because of many of the storylines we've had on David so far, has been from his youth. You've had him as a boy, as a shepherd, subject to the authority of father, other men, King Saul, and you've seen, in essence, the softer side. Now, we didn't see the softer side with Goliath. There's where the character of this young man comes out, and you see this fire that is in him with this desire for justice. Oh, it is there. But it was only getting started. Because the older he gets, the more mature he becomes, the more those characteristics harden. And I will point you, and I'm not turning to it later in the storyline, but by the end of the life of David, when he wants to honor God by building a temple, and he spends all of these years literally laying up the valuable materials to build the temple. And remember, and you already know the story, God doesn't let David do it. It's going to be Solomon, his son, who's actually going to build it. And why? Because God says to David, you're a bloody man. So it's very much similar, I would say it different, but similar to Moses and Joshua. Not that Moses was a bloody man, but in God's scheme, Moses represented the flesh, which can never inherit the kingdom. And Joshua symbolically pictured the spiritual man. Okay? So God didn't, even though God said that Moses was faithful in all his house, he did not let Moses cross the Jordan into the promised land. Moses died and was buried secretly by God on the near side of the Jordan. And so here, in the end of David's life, which we will cover when we get to it, but just to give you a prelude, David is not going to be allowed to build the temple. He showed this love for God. God calls him a man after his own heart. But God says, I'm not going to let you build it. It's going to be your son Solomon, who is a king of peace, who's going to build the temple, because you signify, you represent also the flesh. In that regard, David represented the flesh. And God called him a bloody man. So that's going to be his reputation by the time we get into this. David will have spent the majority of his life fighting wars and killing people. A soldier's life is what David really had. And these years of exile is just the first part of it, because it continues on after he's king. He's going to fight, and he's going to fight, and he's going to fight, and he's going to fight. Well, what is the warrior's mentality? You got to be willing and able to do it if you're going to be successful at it, and David was. Which means you had to have some grit, and you had to have some kind of oomph in you that says you don't put up with the garbage that comes out of certain people. So he had that nature. It was not the nature that God wants from us, but it was David's natural nature, and it's being manifested right here in this story with what he intends to do to Nabal. Because I'm going to wipe this guy out in every mail. I'm not going to put up with it. Verse 23, when Abigail saw David, she hasted and lighted off the ass and fell before David on her face and bowed herself to the ground. Oh, was her interaction with David and his entourage very different than her husband's had been. Verse 24, and fell at his feet, she fell at David's feet and said, upon me, my Lord, upon me let the iniquity be. She's taking responsibility for everything her husband did. It wasn't Abigail's fault. She wasn't any part of what he did and what he said. But here she is, on behalf of her husband and all of her family and their employees, and she's taking responsibility before David. So she's treating David like a warlord. She doesn't know David. She has no idea what his character is, and she's responding to him like the man who's getting ready to slaughter. She says, upon me, my Lord, upon me let this iniquity be, even putting her own life at risk. If he wants blood, she's volunteering to be the martyr so that her husband and family and all of their family enterprise can be spared. That's pretty noble. Upon me, my Lord, upon me let this iniquity be, and let thine handmaid, I pray thee, speak in thine audience and hear the words of thine handmaid. In case David's going to slaughter them all right there, she's saying, can I at least say something? Will you listen to me? You don't have to. I'm bowing before you, but will you please listen? She says, verse 25, let not my Lord, I pray thee, referring to David, regard this man of Belial, even Nabal. So she's telling the truth about her husband. It's not very respectful. But she's not slandering him. Well, you can say she is slandering. She's telling the fact about what he was like and how he behaved. She was not trying to shine David on and say, well, you have to get to know my husband. He's not as bad as he seems. No, she's saying, my husband is an idiot. There's no qualm about it. I admit it. I'm not here to talk you out of thinking he's, or want to try and talk you into thinking he's a good guy. He is not. I pray thee, regard this man Belial, even Nabal. For as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. And so I looked it up. What does the name Nabal actually mean? And it literally means a fool. Now I want to know, what mother would name her son Nabal? It literally means fool. It means stupid. Some translate it as disgraceful. It's a Bible name. I want to see somebody name their child Nabal. I don't think that's going to happen. So I don't know. So the commentators, they disagree on it. The idea that it literally might be a nickname. It may not be his actual given proper name. That's one explanation. I don't know. I'll attach myself to it just because I don't have a better. That he became known for his character and his behavior of a fool, an absolute idiot, and literally has a name that reflects it. Now, don't forget, he's a wealthy, powerful man. So why would he allow himself to be called if it was a nickname? Something that denigrates his character. It's like being called dumbhead or stupid. But that was his name. So Abigail is pointing out to David, Nabal's his name, and that's exactly what he is. He's a fool. And folly, that's foolishness, is with him. But, she says, I, thine handmaid, saw not the young men of my Lord whom thou didst send. She's saying, had your young men found me first, I promise you, I would have treated them very differently than my husband did. Verse 26, now therefore, she says, she implores David, my Lord, as the eternal liveth. So now she's invoking the name of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. As the eternal liveth, and as thy soul liveth, as God is alive and real, and as you are alive and real, David, she's saying, seeing the eternal hath withholden thee from coming to shed blood and from avenging thyself with thine own hand, she's positively, prospectively trying to lay on David what she hopes he will do. And he's given no indication of exactly what he's going to do after her speech. But she's being positive. So she's saying, even as I'm sure God is going to lead you to do the right thing, now, she says, let thine enemies and they that seek evil to my Lord, meaning David, be as Nabal. She's literally invoking the name of God to say, I agree with you taking vengeance on your enemies. She says, I agree with you. I'm on your side. I am not your enemy. She says, I pray that your enemies will suffer like my husband. In other words, she's throwing her husband under the bus. All she's trying to do is protect herself, her family, and all of the employees of her husband's enterprise. So she's already treating Nabal like he's a goner, some way, somehow. And she says, I do not begrudge you the right to take vengeance on any of your enemies, including Nabal. She's just saying, please don't sweep us up with your vengeance. Now let thine enemies and that seek evil to my Lord be as Nabal. Verse 27, and now this blessing which thine handmaid hath brought unto thy Lord, meaning all of this food. Here she is with her good intentions proven out by all of these donkeys laden with all of this food. And she's saying, the blessing which thine handmaid hath brought unto my Lord, let it even be given unto the young men that follow my Lord. She's trying to undo what her husband did and saying, can we rewind, please, as if your men came to me, and here's the answer to your request to show respect to you and your men to give you all this food. Abigail's not finished. But the change happens now because she was speaking directly to David up to now, verse 28. I'm going to call this now a prophecy that God inspired from here on through Abigail. Because now she's going to talk about the future. Notice it in that context, verse 28, she says, I pray thee, forgive the trespass of thine handmaid, even though she wasn't the perpetrator. For, here it is, the Eternal will certainly make my Lord a sure house. She's now prophesying about the future. Now, she's either making up a story just to try and, you know, blow smoke at David, or I would assert to you that God literally is now using her as an instrument to prophesy the future. She says, the Lord will certainly make my Lord, meaning David, a sure house, because my Lord fights the battles of the Eternal, and evil hath not been found in thee all thy days. So Abigail knew David had, she knew exactly who David was. She knew David had a good reputation. Her husband, who's this David? Who's this son of Jesse? I don't know any such guy. And why should I care about some guy who's, you know, the king's trying to kill for good reason? She knew it, which also confirms Nabal knew it too. But she's saying, David has God's favor and will make him a sure house, meaning a dynasty, and that's exactly what's going to happen. And he has had a good reputation because he has dealt fairly and equitably. Verse 29, she says, yet a man is risen to pursue thee, talking about King Saul. A man is risen to pursue thee and to seek thy soul. He's been running for 5 or 6 years at this point. But the soul of my Lord, David, shall be bound in the bundle of life with the Eternal thy God. I didn't take time to look this up, but it just strikes me as if she's eloquently comparing the fact that David is being kept close to God. In essence, he's wrapped David up at his bosom to protect him and to advance him and to bless him. And the souls of thine enemies, by contrast, them shall he sling out as out of the middle of a sling. Is she being clever here? The fact that David is a master with the sling, and now this prophecy is taking that into consideration, something that he will identify with. She says David is like kept in the bosom of God, and the enemies of David are slung out like rocks from a sling, separated from God, apart from him. Verse 30, and it shall come to pass when the Eternal shall have done to my Lord according to all the good that he hath spoken concerning the prophecies of David. Samuel was one of them. I mean, everybody heard it when Samuel said the kingdom has been removed from Saul because he's going to raise up a man who will do all of his will. So this was all public. And became apparent over all these years that David was the guy. And shall have appointed thee ruler over Israel. Did Abigail know that David was God's pick to be king over Israel in place of Saul? Yes. Verse 31, and this shall be no grief unto thee. Meaning this terrible circumstance which you have experienced because of my husband. She's saying compared to everything that is ahead of you in the plan and the will of God to become king over Israel because of your good character, she's saying this incident is going to pale. It's going to become as nothing to you. Right now, it's everything to David, and all he wants is revenge. And she's saying, she's appealing to him, don't come at us with that fire, because you're going to regret it one day, and everything you're experiencing right now is going to be as nothing. This shall be no grief unto thee, verse 31, nor offense of heart unto my Lord. He says, you're not going to care about this in the future. Either that thou hast shed blood causeless, or that my Lord hath avenged himself. In essence, what she's saying is the day is going to come, you're going to be happy that you did not make the mistake that causes God displeasure by taking your revenge on the innocent. But instead, she's implying, when the Eternal shall have dealt well with my Lord, when God blesses you, David, which she's already said she believes is happening, and that he's going to become the king over Israel, and that God's going to make a dynasty out of him and his family. She says, when God blesses you, then remember thine handmaid. She says, remember me, because you're on the way up. You're going to become king. And she's, in essence, she's saying, I'm on your side. Abigail stops talking. Now it's time for David's reply in verse 32. David said to Abigail, blessed be the Eternal God of Israel, which sent thee this day to meet me. Did her speech affect him? You bet it did. Was it words of wisdom? Oh, yeah. Did David recognize it? Yes, he did. Verse 33, and bless, he says, blessed be thy advice, and blessed be thou, which hath kept me this day from coming to shed blood. He's giving her the credit for neutralizing all of his venom that was going to result in slaughter. And he says, because of your words, I've changed my mind. And from avenging myself with mine own hand. Verse 34, for in very deed, as the Eternal God of Israel lives, which hath kept me back from hurting thee. So God is giving credit to God. I mean, David is giving credit to God for intervening to send Abigail to help prevent him from making a terrible mistake. That's how he views it in his mind. Except thou had hasted and come to meet me, surely there had not been left unto Nabal by the morning light any that pisseth against the wall. He says, I literally was going to slaughter every male in your household. Verse 35, so David received of her hand that which she had brought him. He accepted all the food laden on these donkeys and said unto her, go in peace to thine house. See, I have hearkened to thy voice and have accepted thy person. Which means he turned around with his 400 soldiers and went back to his camp and left off his plan for revenge on Nabal. Abigail then returns to her husband with her report. Her intent was not to deceive him long term. She wasn't really working some long term scheme behind her husband's back to undermine her husband's enterprise. She was literally saving her husband's life and that of all of their household, even though she violated technically his authority. Verse 36, and Abigail came to Nabal. She went right to him. Her intent was not to keep him in the dark about what she had done, creating a league with David behind his back. She went out and solved the problem by keeping him from being slaughtered. And then her next move was now to go and report to her husband. And behold, he held a feast in his house. Remember, it was a time of feasting for the shearers. He was taking full advantage of it. Like the feast of a king. In essence, he was like a little mini king out in this wilderness area where he presided. And Nabal's heart was merry with him, for he was very drunken. He was living, he was eating, drinking, and being merry. Wherefore, she told him nothing. It was not the right time. She went with the intention of immediately filling her husband in on everything that happened. But he's drunk at this party, and there's no way that's a good time in order to try to talk to him. She told him nothing less or more until the morning light. She had to wait till he was sober. Verse 37, but it came to pass in the morning, when the wine was gone out of Nabal, he's sober now, probably with a really bad hangover, and his wife had told him these things, she makes her report and tells Nabal everything that happened after he showed disrespect to the servants of David. Everything that she did, including loading up those donkeys with all of that food and going out herself with it and putting herself at risk, meeting David, everything she told David, and everything that David replied. She told him the whole story. She didn't hold anything back. His wife told him these things. And what was Nabal's response? His heart died within him, and he became as a stone. Now, a lot of different interpretations, and the scholars say this and say this. But verse 30, I'll give verse 38 and then give some commentary. It came to pass, whatever it is, it says his heart died within him and became as a stone. And it came to pass about 10 days later, days after, that the Eternal smote Nabal that he died. So did he just have a hangover, and was this, his heart died within him, was that just an emotional response? He became as a stone, was it? Or was there a physical manifestation that literally after his wife told him what happened and how close he had been to death and having all of them wiped out because of the disrespect he showed to David, and that the physical response was that, in essence, he had a stroke and became like a stone? Don't know. A lot of commentators think it's possible when it says his heart died within him, or did he have a heart attack? Paralyzed him? Did he have a seizure of some kind that literally made him immobile, but it took him 10 days to die? Or was this just metaphors to say, in mind, he died? He knew how close he'd come to destroying everything because of his surly nature and his disrespect for David, and it, in essence, emotionally took the life out of him. And then 10 days later, did God like hit him with a lightning bolt of some kind, if you will, and strike him dead? Or literally, did he immediately after his wife's testimony have a seizure of some kind? And then did God literally kill him 10 days later with the result of whatever that was? Either way, what we know, God intervened to strike him down. He did not have a natural death. This was God-induced, God-prompted. So here this man showed disrespect to David, and God killed him. That's pretty phenomenal. That's what happened. It says, the Lord smote Nabal. Why did Nabal die? God struck him down. The volition of God, it wasn't natural circumstances. God struck him down, and he died 10 days after all of this happened. Even if there was then, therefore, some medical diagnosis on record, oh, he had COVID or whatever, God is the one who killed him with intent, made an example out of him. It was divine judgment. What's the aftermath of Nabal's death? Verse 39, when David heard that Nabal was dead, David didn't know what was going to happen. David simply accepted the wise testimony of Abigail, which says, do not take your vengeance because you will regret it. One day later, when God promotes you and makes you king over the nation, you'll regret it. So he had no evidence whatsoever of what God was going to do. Maybe Nabal was going to be like Saul. Maybe he was going to continue to be a thorn in the flesh of David that David was going to have to put up with. David just made the right choice at that time and backed off and put it in God's hands. Then he found out 10 days later, God struck Nabal down. David heard that Nabal was dead and said, blessed be the Eternal that hath pleaded the cause of my reproach from the hand of Nabal. Thank God. Finally, David is saying that it's time for me to get a little bit of justice. Because he's not had a lot of it, fleeing like a vagabond for all of these years. And hath kept his servant from evil. meaning that God held me back from taking things in my own hands to my own detriment. Because in essence, this was a case where God was fighting for David. David didn't have to defend himself. God was going to fight David's battles for him. He just had to be patient and act with confidence. And David says, "For the Eternal hath returned the wickedness of Nabal upon his own head." Nabal got what he deserves. The book of Proverbs is full of admonitions about doing what's right, because eventually what goes around comes around. And it's true. So David was glad after the fact that he did not take matters into his own hands, but let God be his defender. And even as David would not raise his hand against Saul, God is showing anyone who attacks David, who is God's anointed, the future king in waiting, is going to have God for an enemy. So David showed that respect by not raising his hand against Saul. God is in turn showing respect to David and saying, "You're the one I've picked. Woe be to anybody who fights you, because they're fighting me." And he made an example out of Nabal to prove it. And David sent and communed with Abigail. He sent an entourage in order to communicate with her. Doesn't say he went himself, as we'll see, to take her to him and to wife. He sent somebody to ask her to marry him. That's what happened here. "And when the servants of David were come to Abigail," so it wasn't David in person, it was his servants. "When the servants of David were come to Abigail to Carmel, they spake unto her, saying, David sent us unto thee to take thee to him to wife." David wants to marry you. He wants you to come with us. "And she arose," verse 41, "and bowed herself to her on her face to the earth," showing humility, "and said, Behold, let thine handmaid be a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord." She's not treating him like, "Oh, he wants to marry me. Ha ha, I'm going to get to be queen." Her response is incredibly humble. She says, "I would be willing, literally, to wash the feet of the people who washed the feet of David, the servant of the servants." That's her orientation. Verse 42, "And Abigail hasted and arose and rode upon an ass with five damsels of her that went after her," her entourage of ladies. "And she went after the messengers of David," meaning followed them, "and became his wife." Verse 43, "David also took Ahinoam of Jezreel." And they were also, both of them, meaning Abigail and Ahinoam, both of them his wives. I mean, why settle for one when you can have two? So that's what happened. He married two of them. Verse 44, "But Saul," well, here's the story. Well, wait a minute. What? David's married. He's got a wife. Her name is Michal. This is the daughter of King Saul. Back in the court of Saul at home. What about her? Verse 44, "But Saul had given Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to Phalti, the son of Laish, which was of Galim." Well, David had to be free to marry, right? Because Saul took his wife and gave her to another man. Now she's married to him, which means David's free. Oh, no. But the facts on the ground are, Michal was not with David. All of these years now, she chose her father over her husband. And David, well, and Saul, in order literally to show vengeance against David, he's not been able to kill him. So he marries Michal off to another man. That'll teach him. That's not a marriage. But they're acting like they're married. It's adultery. And what David is now doing is adultery. Because even though his wife is not with him, he's not free to marry. So Abigail was never his lawful wife, neither was Ahinoam. Are those the only women that David's going to marry? Oh no. He can't settle for one, two, or three wives. He's going to have a whole bevy of them. And a whole bunch of kids. We're going to see later, when we get to 2 Samuel chapter 3, once he begins to rule in Judah, at least under the southern portion of the nation, for 7 years. He has 6 sons by 6 different women. And the firstborn, by the way, is not from Abigail, it's from Ahinoam. So this handmaid of Abigail is actually going to bear his firstborn, but not while they're in the wilderness. This is the interesting thing about it. So again, I gave you and repeated the timeline because there's likely about another 4 years or so before Saul and Jonathan are going to be killed and David's going to actually begin to rule over part of Israel from Hebron. And he doesn't have any children until he's ruling. And yet he just married these 2 women in the wilderness. Somehow he doesn't have any kids while they're on the lam. But he starts having kids once he's partially on the throne. And his firstborn is going to be from this handmaid of Abigail. Abigail's child is going to be second to him, at least in counting the sons. So just to give you kind of the overview of what's coming, there's 19 named sons of David in the Bible, 1 named daughter, Tamar. We're going to see all about her. Plus, do you think that's all? He just had 20 children? Oh, no. It says, plus other children, unnamed. I wonder how many total children David have by how many different women. My point is a lot. Well, you might ask, how could he be a man after God's own heart when he was committing adultery thus? And I would love to say that we're just going to move right on into chapter 26 next time, but we need to answer that question. We need to answer this question about polygamy and God's dealing with the patriarchs of old, including David and all of his women. So I'm going to get behind. I'm not going to be able to continue to match sermon by chapter because we're going to take a time out in the next and we're going to go back and study this whole issue about the patriarchs, Old Testament polygamy, what Mr. Armstrong said about it, what the Bible says about it, and how we put it in context of all these things that are important, including the commandments of God, including the 7th commandment against adultery. Next time, we'll do that.
The Church of God the Eternal has just presented the 25th message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, April 18th, 2026.